One of the more colorful chapters in Oregon history closed more than 30 years ago when the religious leader Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh left Oregon, attempting to flee the country ahead of federal prosecution. That subject and object together, religious leader and federal prosecution, gives you just a hint of how exciting things got at the former Big Muddy Ranch, renamed Rajneeshpuram in the early 1980s. At its peak, Rajneeshpuram was a place of thousands of happy, devoted followers of the Bhagwan. At its nadir, it was a place where murder plots were hatched against the public officials who tried to keep the Rajneeshis within the bounds of the law. Netflix put out a documentary series this year, Wild, Wild Country. Interest in Rajneesh and his followers is renewed. This month, our Underground History segment, a joint venture with the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, turns attention to Rajneeshpuram, a.k.a. Big Muddy Ranch. Chelsea Rose from Sula is our guest in the studio once again. Chelsea, always good to have you.
Hi, great to be here.
And we have with us as well Dennis Griffin, the state archaeologist who has spent some time at the Big Muddy Ranch. Dennis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Matthew Cowan is a film archivist at the Oregon Historical Society who assisted the folks working on the Netflix series. Thank you for joining us, Matthew.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Matt, I have to believe there must be months, if not years, of video and film of Rajneesh and his followers in Oregon.
Yes. I mean, specifically what we have is actually from the news stations, from KGW, which is a local news station here in Portland, and it's 512 tapes, which works out to just over 300 hours of raw footage. So just raw B-roll footage of just going to show up and just rolling the, you know, the video cameras and just seeing what they recorded. And it's just, it's everything. It's a massive amount. So it's everything. It's not a lot of what you would see in the studio. So not a lot of people reporting from behind a desk. Most of it's on location reporting either at the ranch or in downtown Portland, or there's even some discotheques in Berlin or traveling around, things like that.
So this is raw stuff you were saying, not the finished stories?
It is raw stuff. So it's stuff that they would take out and that they would include in their own nightly broadcast, say in the local Portland or Eugene market, but it's also stuff that they would send to sister stations in Seattle or New York or L.A. So that was then cut into what would have been the final broadcast that went out. But usually most final broadcasts were never saved as they went out live over the air. So usually what's saved is the tape that was shot.
Right.
The B-roll.
Yeah, having worked in TV myself, I can relate to say, well, I think I'm going to need this one later. So there's that tape that sits on a shelf for a while, and then something interesting happens and you pull it out again. Have you laid eyeballs on most of the 300 hours of this stuff yourself?
No. I get asked that all the time, or I get asked for looking for specific footage. Somebody wants a specific shot, and I can try to find it for them. But that is often a multi-hour quest. Usually, up until this project, we would provide this footage to people in very, very small chunks. So it was actually never, most of it was never digitized. I would say maybe 40 or 50 hours of the total was digitized up until the Wild Wild Country project. And so most of the projects that were using it were kind of hitting the main points. And so they were interested in the Rolls Royces, they're interested in gun footage, they're interested in, which I don't think we ever really found, you know, footage of the salad bars or things like that. They were really focused towards the end of the era of Rajneeshpuram, and those clips tend to be pretty easy to find.
So is the stuff on, I'm curious to know, is it on beta tape or 3/4 inch?
It is on 3/4 inch. We have a little bit that's on 16 millimeter. So the other interesting thing from a film archivist perspective is right around the late 70s and the early 80s is when the station started to transfer away from using 16 millimeter to shoot their on-location B-roll, and they transferred over to 3/4 inch U-matic video, which is kind of a slightly higher-end version of VHS tape or beta tape at that time.
Yeah, big clunky boxes. Yeah, I remember that very
well. Exactly. But still, you know, you put it into a deck now, and it 99 out of 100 will play just fine. Maybe not quite that high, but quite a number. Of the 512 tapes, I think all of them played fine except for about 25, which had to be sent on to a special lab to be transferred.
So Matt, talk about the creation of Wild Wild Country. How did that come about?
I mean, I can only speak from my perspective. The filmmakers are amazing, and they did all of the work. All I was involved in is that they previously did a film called The Battered Bastards of Baseball, which I highly recommend. I believe it's also still on Netflix, which is about the Portland Mavericks, which were kind of a funky 1970s baseball team, which was run by Bing Russell, who was kind of a character actor and known as the father of Kurt Russell and just kind of an all-around weird story. And so they were up, and they got a lot of footage from the Historical Society for that film. And I believe It was the summer of 2014, so they were in town wrapping up that project. They were premiering Battered Bastards of Baseball here at the Witzel at the Portland Art Museum, and in conversation, we were just kind of kicking around asking what they were doing in their next project, and I kind of pitched them this idea of the Rajneeshpuram and of all these tapes, because it's something, it's a massive collection that we have, especially from that time period, and it's something that I thought is always never been fully appreciated. I think, as I said before, people tend to concentrate on the bad things and not kind of all the interesting things that led up to the quote-unquote bad things at the end. And, you know, they, I think, were probably get pitched a lot of things and hear a lot of ideas, and so they kind of just said, oh, yeah, that's great, that's weird, and just left. And then about a month or two later, they got back in touch, and clearly they had been doing a lot of research and were kind of interested in moving forward with it.
Well, three nouns you dropped there that I want to get to later in the hour, and this is the whole hour we're doing this. Rolls, Rolls-Royces, guns, and salads. So a lot to discuss here. This is our Underground History segment on steroids. Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology back in the studio with me. On the phone, we have Matthew Cowan, the film archivist at the Oregon Historical Society, and Dennis Griffin, the Oregon State Archaeologist. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Maybe you have stories to share of your time in Oregon when the Rajneeshis were here, or perhaps we're there. We'd like to hear from you at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Dennis, give us a little history here. This the land was Big Muddy Ranch, and I guess is again, right?
It is. Well, yeah, now it's owned by the New Life, I think a Christian group that has camps there for youth. But it was a Big Muddy Ranch, and the Bhagwan's group bought it in the early 80s.
When have you done digs there or done work there?
Well, yeah, I was actually employed by the BLM. In 1984, there was a proposed land exchange, the Muddy Ranch Land Exchange, for several thousand acres. The Muddy Ranch is not a one solid block of land. The BLM owns many little segments. And there was a big deal going on to exchange a lot of the land along the John Day River that the Bhagwan had owned, the Rancho Rajneesh people had owned, to the BLM, and the BLM would give them all these little internal pieces. So I was hired, as well as another archaeologist, to go on there and to work with the Rajneeshis to access all these pretty much inaccessible parcels of the BLM land, to survey those to make sure any land going out of federal ownership would not have significant archaeological sites.
And what did you find there in the way of archaeological sites?
Well, it was great. I mean, we went through the first year, 1985, a different group of archaeologists were out there. We found quite a few sites. There are pictograph, you know, rock art sites, burials, village sites, house village sites, lithic scatters, the whole gamut of prehistoric sites. And we worked with their archaeologist. They actually had one named Ma Bodhitaru. And we had a guide, which was Sheila's husband, Swami Prem Jayananda, who went with us every day. So we had a great window for about 8 months. We were there pretty much 15 hours a day working with on the ranch.
And the Sheila you mentioned, this is Ma Anand Sheila, who was the right-hand person of the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh?
It is. Well, I had met her a couple of different times where I was in the Muddy Ranch having a beer with the other people after work. I didn't really deal with her much, but her husband, yeah, was our guide, so we were with him every day.
So aside from the contact with him, did you have much contact with the people there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he and the archaeologists, their archaeologists, we were with every day. And then we had lunch and snacks often with them. We'd be in the discotheque or the casino at night. We spent quite a bit of time there trying to see what was really going on.
And in what sense did you get what general feeling were you left with in having seen all this stuff firsthand?
Well, remember, I was there in 1984. Mm-hmm. That was a pretty good year.
Yeah,
there was nothing with salad bars going on. There were hardly any guns. The only guns we ever saw was their peace force, their police force. And they were usually in little phone booths, you know, along the roads, checking people coming in. And the only time I ever saw a gun was when the Bhagwan would drive through in his Rolls Royce. There was someone behind the Rolls Royce with a gun there. Otherwise, I never saw one. So all the stuff you hear about in the papers and on the news, that came later on, and I didn't witness that. So we were with a lot of people. I talked to tons of people when I was there. They were quite open. And I really enjoyed I wasn't into what they were doing, the cult part of the thing there, but I thought the people were great, lots of very smart people, and they were doing things in that land that I never thought could happen. It was really a miracle what they were doing to the land.
Like what?
Well, they had the reservoir, they built the dam, They had a water filtration system. That even the urine was being recycled back into plants. They were growing fruit trees that would never grow in that area. They had lots of crops, huge gardens. They built a huge greenhouse. The greenhouse didn't quite work the way they wanted it to, but they were really trying to make the ground productive. I thought that was wonderful.
I know. I read somewhere, and I think it was in a post Rajneeshi description of the facilities at the ranch, that they had a sewage system that was big enough for 5,000 people.
That's what I heard as well, yeah. I have a lot of pictures. I would go back every 5 years afterwards to see how it's changed. And they had a little crematorium there, a white marble crematorium. The downtown, I think, is still pretty much the same. I haven't gone back for a few years. But most of the A-frames are gone, the other kinds of structures. There has been some damage, you know, some of the structures. There's some arson going on there. But when we were there, we got to go pretty much anywhere we wanted to go. And it was quite eye-opening for us. And I was there before, during, and after the homeless came in. So I watched that whole situation develop. It was kind of interesting.
All right. All kinds of aspects of life at the Rajneesh Param to take into account here. We haven't even dealt with the fact that they also managed to get enough people voting in the nearby city of Antelope to change the name of Antelope, Oregon to Rajneesh, Oregon. So lots of discussion topics here on Underground History. You can join us at 800-838-3760 with Dennis Griffin, the state archaeologist, Matthew Cowan, film archivist of the Oregon Historical Society, and Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. Mark Tveskov is off in the wilderness this month. So, Chelsea, as a person approaching this really significant chapter in American history, I mean, it must get easier over time to place it in some sort of historical context.
It does, and I think one of the things that really stands out to me about this moment in time was the foresight of the news company to save this footage, but also just to think about you know, you can really track this story. Most people, it kind of somehow people forgot about it. A lot of people, younger people, didn't even know about it. But you can kind of track this story across the state once you start looking into it. Like a lot of little communities had, I know in Ashland, we had a restaurant here that was Rajneesh run. We also, a lot of, after the Big Muddy kind of closed, a lot of those structures went out, were purchased by ranches. I know somebody told me they stayed in some of those A-frames on some like ranch where you could stay, you know, farther south. The bathrooms, apparently some of the bathrooms at the Brit Festival here in Jacksonville were from the Big Muddy Ranch. So, you know, there's a lot of that material culture that's made its way across the state, but it seemed like until this Netflix documentary, kind of a lot of people forgot about the story. So I think that's really interesting because it talks about heritage and kind of the responsibility. And one of the things that's really interesting about what we do is to try to save these stories because you never know what stories are going to kind of capture the attention of the public at a certain time in the future. So the responsibility is to kind of think what's the story that really tells us about our history in Oregon. And this certainly is an interesting one.
Boy, no kidding. And then Dennis Griffin made reference to the different aspects of things going on at different times, all the people there, for example. But Matthew Cowan, certainly a change in tone over time. Dennis mentioned that he was there in 1984 when things were still pretty good. Things turned very ugly in 1985 when we started getting into things like the murder plots against public officials, the salmonella spraying on a salad bar, and I think it was at the Dalles.
Mm-hmm.
And so Matthew, I mean, I would just wonder if the tape reflects the change in mood there in the last year of Rajneesh Param.
Yes, definitely. The tape, you know, so they purchased the ranch in 81, I believe, and the it didn't really, from what I can tell, didn't really get on the radar of local news until 83. So the tape is really runs 83 through kind of the end of the community and, you know, the kind of the footage you might have seen in the documentary, which is them getting on the planes and trying to leave and then people kind of being left behind. So there's a lot of footage of actually all, you know, the quote-unquote leadership is gone and it's just the followers who are still there. And there's a lot of interviews with people trying to figure out what they're going to do next and how do they feel and do they still believe in the Bhagwan and do they, you know, a lot of questions about Sheila and trying to kind of even then trying to kind of place her in a role of some kind, either good or evil. And so it's very interesting to see. And the other interesting thing is a lot of the cameramen who were doing the interviews, there was kind of an almost antagonistic nature. Like you could tell a lot of them weren't necessarily sympathetic and they were kind of there watching what they saw as kind of a train wreck, I think. And so there was an interesting level of, or lack of subjectivity, I think, in some of the stuff too. So there was kind of this, knowledge of what was going on was somehow different or maybe not right, and they were kind of there to record it as well.
Dennis Griffin, you mentioned a bunch of smart people there at Rajneesh Pram when you were at the ranch in 84, and there were people who had just uprooted their lives in different parts of the country and had sold off everything they had just to join this operation. Is that a story that you heard fairly commonly?
It was. In fact, I think I heard at the time that they had the highest level, education level per capita of any town in the world. There were lots of people with PhDs there.
And what was the amount of time you spent altogether during this survey with the BLM in 84?
About 8 months on the ranch itself.
Mm-hmm. And was it appealing? I mean, for somebody like you, an outsider, who granted you're there for, you know, scientific researchy purposes, I mean, was there anything, did it appeal to you on some level?
It did in a lot of ways. They wanted us to stay on the ranch, and we did not want that because we wanted to keep a little bit of a barrier between us. So we were living in a trailer just off the ranch. We'd come in the morning, we'd spend the whole day there. And, you know, archaeology is a subdiscipline of anthropology, so any kind of a cultural differences are fascinating to us. So we loved that part and the opportunity. And many, many people there were from other places of the world, other Europeans and so on. So we had lots of conversations with people. And a lot of them gave their fortunes to the Bhagwan, and they just said this is where they want to be. And so a lot of good conversations over dinner.
The giving the fortunes to the Bhagwan accounts for one of the nouns we used in here, Rolls Royces. Matthew, want to roll that one out for us?
Yeah, you know, I don't even know if I can, but he was known for, I believe, having a fleet of Rolls Royces. I believe, you know, a dozen, two dozen, quite a number of them, and he would come out at certain points during the day and kind of do a parade through town or through the community in the Rolls Royce and kind of wave. And so there's lots and lots and lots of footage of these kind of slow rolls through town where he's waving. And as Dennis was saying, there's people behind kind of walking with AK-47s who are kind of with sunglasses and kind of these pink security outfits and carrying guns behind us. A lot of show, I think.
I remember watching some of that footage living in Wisconsin in 1984, coming down the network feed, and you know, it's like he has this guy in Oregon who has all these followers and all these Rolls Royces, and he comes out once a day and drives past them and waves at them, and that's actually the picture on our website too. But I remember thinking, wow, this is really wild. Then of course I moved to Oregon a year later and got a real sense of what was going on.
I grew up sorry, Matthew.
Well, I was going to say that I think I've heard rumors that some of those Rolls Royces are still around, and that even somewhat within promotion of Wild Wild Country, there's talk of there's one down in L.A., I think, or something like that. And so the Rolls Royces, kind of like Chelsea was saying, with the A-frames are still around, or the bathrooms are, you know, little pieces of that community are still kind of around in the world. And, you know, maybe I heard one's in Texas and one's down in Los Angeles and one somewhere else.
Yeah, that'd be amazing to try to, you know, if you can really establish the provenience of those artifacts, car artifacts. My mom told me, I grew up in Northern California off 395, and she said she remembered in the 80s, like, a fleet of Rolls Royces just driving through town one day, and everybody was just like, what is this?
Oh, and 395 would get you up to the
big money.
Yeah, and
they were heading up there. So, you know, it's really fascinating, the reach, I guess, of this community. But I had a question for Dennis. When you were there, did you know, we all have the benefit of hindsight now, but did you have any sense of the direction this would turn, or did you kind of think that maybe this crazy idea would work?
Well, personally, I thought it could have worked because when I was there, I really got a good feeling for what they were doing to the land. I mean, it was quite eye-opening. For instance, a lot of the land, they built a big fence to protect the animals, and you could see deer out and about, and a day before the hunting season started, all the deer started jumping this fence, and the locals didn't like it because they used to hunt the grounds all the time. But I thought the people really cared about the resource themselves a lot. However, I thought that there were, like, I would hear at night on the radio, I would hear our Attorney General or the Secretary of State just bad-mouthing the place all the time and saying, oh my God, they're all carrying guns, this is horrible. I'm walking around all day, and I'm not seeing this at all. I'm seeing a whole different part. So the only negative thing I ever saw actually on the ranch would be Sheila. Every time I came near her, she was screaming at somebody on the phone, and oftentimes it was Frohmeyer or someone else. But I really thought most people really wanted it to work, and I think if they would have gone slower, it could have.
Huh. So that is interesting. So your contacts with Sheila were all of a type, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, Sheila, of course, didn't deal with the likes of me, but I recall, for instance, one night we were in the Big Money Ranch. We were invited in to relax and have a beer in their living room, and they had two kegs of beer on tap, and one was Guinness. And I thought, oh, I'd be glad to. And in the hallway, you hear the screaming going on, and Jay, her husband, came over and said, oh, don't mind, no, that's just Sheila over there. I said, who is she yelling at? And it was Frohmeyer, the attorney general. So there was definitely some tension there between the state forces and the Rajneeshis.
Right.
The people who were living on the land themselves were pretty mellow and just into working.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like they had quite the environmental ethic and some sense of sustainability.
They did.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, unlike what, you know, I was kind of surprised at this too. I had heard these guys were out there volunteering their time, working really hard all day, all night, and it really wasn't like that at all. They didn't work even 8 hours a day, probably. I mean, they went out in the morning, they had a good breakfast, they had great food. Good morning, they worked a couple hours, have a morning snack, huge bowls of tofu and salad. Then they have a long lunch period, about a three-hour lunch period, in order to have lunch and then to wait for the Bhagwan to drive through. And then they worked in the afternoon. So they might have put in 5 or 6 hours of work, and they were all just kind of going about their own pace. It was kind of nice and relaxing, but yet you saw progress.
Dennis, did you ever lay eyes on the Bhagwan himself? Were you there for one of the Rolls-Royce drive-bys?
I did. I did not do it for a long time. I just did not want to go that route, but I thought, come on, I'm here. I might as well do it. So, yeah. And I wanted to see, people kept saying, when you look into his eyes, you feel this magnetism. So I thought, all right, I'm a little skeptical, but let's check it. So I stood there and I watched him drive by me. Didn't take any photos of him, but I did watch him go by. I didn't feel anything. But, yeah, he was there with his diamond-encrusted armbands and watches and stuff, yeah.
And what did you observe in the people around you as the Rolls drove by and they made eye contact?
They were totally in love, head over heels, putting roses on the car, roses on the road in front of the car. They adored it.
All right. I should point out that these arguments with Dave Frohnmayer, who was then the Attorney General of Oregon, and Norma Paulus would have been Secretary of State for a good chunk of this time, was that there was a fair amount of rule bending going on, including the attempt to incorporate Rajneeshpuram as a city, which was a bit more complicated under Oregon law than the Rajneeshis tried to do. So this is what put the Rajneeshis at odds with public officials in Oregon, and we can get into law enforcement aspects and all that sort of thing too. And things turned darker later with the salad bar attack and the murder plots on the Oregon U.S. attorney and things like that. But much more to talk about here in our Underground History segment, an extended version of it. We'll come back with Chelsea Rose in the studio, Dennis Griffin, the state archaeologist on the phone, Matthew Cowan, film archivist from the Oregon Historical Society, and you. You can join us by phone or email when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. It's 8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're online at jeffexchange.org, on Facebook, on Twitter at Jeff Exchange, and you can take part in the program as it happens. We'll tell you how in just a moment, because I want to catch you up. We're talking about one of the more colorful chapters in Oregon history. It closed more than 30 years ago when the religious leader Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh left Oregon attempting to flee the country ahead of federal prosecution. And so we're picking things up on the discussion of underground history. This is this month's edition of Underground History, our regular segment with the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. Chelsea Rose from SULA joins me again for a scan of Rajneesh Param, once and now again the Big Muddy Ranch in Wasco County in north central Oregon. It was home to Bhagwan and Sri Rajneesh and his followers from 1981 to 1985. Our guests have researched and archived the record of the Rajneeshis, and in Dennis Griffin's case, actually visited the place while it was still Rajneesh Param. He's the state archaeologist. Matthew Cowan is a film archivist at the Oregon Historical Society, and you can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Share your memories of the time of the Rajneeshis in Oregon. So, Matthew Cowan, I wonder what kind of assistance the folks who produced the Netflix documentary Wild Wild Country out this year asked for. You mentioned that they came back after they'd done some research, and so I wonder how much more specific their requests were after that departure.
Well, the main thing is, so as I said previously, like the tapes hadn't been digitized yet, so the first aspect really of the project was to figure out how to take those 512 tapes and get them digitized. There's no place in Oregon or the Northwest that does that, so we actually ended up sending them to a company in Raleigh, North Carolina, that did the majority of that work. Kind of in that process of those 512, they realized that there was about 25 or 30 tapes that actually had some kind of shedding. They had the magnetic material on the tape had dried up, and they needed to be sent to a separate location that was actually in Tennessee, a different facility. And so that whole process took probably 6 months, I would imagine. So now we're talking into early mid-2015. In addition, we also pulled, we have a lot of 16 millimeter on the material about the Rajneeshpuram. We also have paper collections, things like that. So there's kind of a research that started happening. And then they kind of went out on their own, kind of following those leads, which, you know, led them eventually to interviewing Sheila in Switzerland and tracking down other members who were interviewed as part of that project. But a lot of it was just probably going to University of Oregon, going to City Archives, going back to the paper archives at the Oregon Historical Society, just kind of trying to gather all of that stuff together and just start to make sense of something that was so, you know, it was a massive project that included many hundreds, if not thousands, of people. And so there was a lot to kind of gather and kind of collate.
Are there things available now, records available now, that help us better understand what happened then? I mean, there's always the sense of things being released years later or conversations that are had past tense that give people a sense of what actually happened at the time. Is there a lot of that available now, Matthew?
I mean, to my knowledge, yes, but I think a lot of it was just kind of there under the surface. I think there have kind of been kind of light attempts at doing documentaries or kind of brief approaches to kind of tackling the subject, but I think all that material was really there even, you know, many years ago, but it just nobody had really taken the time, and it really is a lot of time. There was probably 2 years of just kind of sorting through all that material and doing the interviews, and nobody had really taken the time to kind of approach it. And also, 2018, streaming services like Netflix and Amazon, for the first time you really have a platform, a digital platform that can actually support a six and a half hour documentary. That project probably wouldn't have been something that would have been made even 5 years ago.
I was wondering, Matthew, if you guys have other sorts of collections. Like, I was curious what's in your paper collections, but also if you have, you know, clothing or jewelry or any of the propaganda that came out along with this.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, it's funny. Netflix, they actually got in touch after. So Wild Wild Country, it kind of blew up. I think everybody's expectations were kind of blown out of the water. So it led to, which is great for the Historical Society, all kinds of press. And so Netflix actually got in touch because I think to promote their project, I think with award season coming up, they were looking if we had materials in our collection that they could put on display down in Los Angeles as part of their award season. So we did do a quick look to see what physical three-dimensional objects we have. And mainly what we have are we have, like, buttons, some T-shirts, posters. We have things that were kind of taken down, kind of no trespassing signs, things like that. So honestly, in the grand scheme of things, very little. I would say less than 20 objects. We do have some paper collections. Like, we have the Norma Paulus collection. We also have... There's a gentleman named Jeffrey Knowles who was an immigration lawyer and represented the Bhagwan and other people in the community in kind of immigration issues, which also started to come up in the later part of the 84, 85. And then there's just lots of states, land, kind of issue records that some are at the Historical Society, some are at the State Archives, some are probably even at the City Archive or even out in Wasco County.
Any of those dark red Rajneesh Peace Force shirts make it to you? Because I know a bunch of them were being sold in Southern Oregon for a time at a shop in Medford.
You know, I don't think we have one. That would be part of our museum collection, and we did generate a report for that request for Netflix, and I don't remember seeing any of that clothing on there, though I can tell just in terms of popular culture, that seems to be one aspects of the story that people seem to really enjoy is kind of the fashion choices, I think.
Underground History, our segment has expanded this month to talk about the Rajneeshi period in Oregon history. We have Chelsea Rose from Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology with us as usual. Dennis Griffin is the state archaeologist and Matthew Cowan, film archivist at the Oregon Historical Society. Do you have a story of the Rajneeshi's time in Oregon? Did you come into contact with them or did you make some observations from afar about what you saw going on? 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Al in Eugene. Welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you for taking my call. In the mid-80s, I was a geology student, and we had a geology field camp not far from the Rajneesh, and we used to observe the Bhagwan go by every day with different young ladies driving different Rolls Royce. And I recall also the Oregonian covered them a lot, especially in the summer when they had these huge parties where they have plane robins like red dye, and then when the Bhagwan fled, I think they fled in two planes, and they were stopped in I think one of the Carolinas. They were trying to hit to the Bahamas, I think.
Yeah,
and he was brought back to Oregon, And they interviewed the sheriff who came back with him. He said he was really a nice guy, except he thinks he's God. You know, otherwise he was really fine. And then what happened also, a bunch of them, I think, fled to Switzerland. And I think among them was Sheila. And they brought them back. And I think they served time in jail in Oregon. But what really intrigued me at that time, when I was a student at Portland State, there were people who were coming from around them who were collecting signature, opposing their president, but there were a lot of sympathy for them, at least around the campus. Mm-hmm. I would like to know if any of your guests would know what happened to those people like Sheila and the other ladies who fled to Switzerland and they were brought back.
Well, Sheila, we just spoke about, was actually interviewed for the Netflix series you mentioned, right, Matthew?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, and does anybody really know the fate of many? Now, we should talk about the Bhagwan himself, who did accept deportation, ended up back in Pune, India, where he changed his name to Osho and had an ashram there until he died a few years later. Rest, I don't know, really. Matthew, is that something that has come across your attention?
Yeah, the rest, I don't know for sure. I know something I've heard about Sheila is that she actually did go to jail. I don't believe it was for federal. I think it was for state charges. I forget the specific details, but I heard that she actually was released early, almost accidentally, and then was able to go to Switzerland and marry a Swiss man and kind of take up residency there. But from what I understand is actually the federal government was interested in scooping her up before she was actually released from state custody, but that never happened because of a kind of a mix-up of paperwork. So she was actually able to leave because of that, and now, from what I understand, is she can't really leave Switzerland. I don't know if they, you know, the level that they would track her down, but if she came to the United States or a country that would is, you know, friendly with the United States in terms of judicial transfers, she would, in theory, could be kind of tried again. So now if you see her for a while country, there's a lot of press. She's being interviewed a lot. She's being beamed in remotely, or they're interviewing her in Switzerland. She's not leaving Switzerland.
Dennis Griffin, have you watched the documentary series Wild Wild Country?
I have not. I've heard about it, and I want to, but I have not seen it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was just going to check and see how what you would see in the documentary compares with what you saw there in real life. The subject of homeless people was brought in. I think, Matthew, you might have brought that up. Would you elaborate on what happened with homeless people coming to Rajneesh Param?
Yeah. So it is my understanding, and some of this is just honestly from me, having seen the documentary. I was not a scholar of the community prior to that, except just through my job. So they were, the general story is that they were interested in increasing their numbers. And so they reached out, they basically sent kind of emissaries almost around the country to bus stations and downtowns of downtown American cities. And they offered free bus tickets to get to Portland to anybody who wanted to take it. And so that led to probably hundreds, maybe even more than hundreds of, you know, that community, the houseless community, showing up in Portland and then being bused by private buses from Portland out to Wasco County. And there's lots and lots of footage of them working, having meals, being engaged in the community, being part of the community. I don't know. Dennis said that he also engaged with that community as well there, so I don't know if he can speak more to that on that level. But it then led to, you know, the charge was that they were brought in to vote specifically for the Rajneesh Purim needs at the time, and I believe that that ended up not happening. So then they just kind of got left with a lot of this community, and clearly that's a huge number of people to be feeding and clothing and dealing with. And so that kind of led to various issues where they then were kind of, you know, left to walk away or kind of encourage them to leave, I think, after a while.
Now, the voting aspect of that did result in a permanent change to, well, permanent so far anyway, change to Oregon law, which was that because of the perceived influence of the Rajneeshis, Oregon changed from a same-day voter registration, which would be rather impossible now on a vote-by-mail system, I guess, but to a three-week prior registration system. So that is one of the legacies of the Rajneeshis in Oregon. I want to ask Chelsea, though, the idea of a religious utopia in the American West is not unknown. I mean, so Rajneesh Purim, in a sense, really was continuing a larger story of other sects.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of instances, not only in the you know, the 20th century, but also earlier. One of the my kind of bucket list archaeological sites is called New Odessa, and it's near Glendale, and it was kind of a utopian community for Russian Jewish immigrants in the 1880s, and they were vegetarian, and they survived mainly by being lumberjacks. So to me, that seems like another really fascinating moment in time. It wasn't successful ultimately, but yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people, there was this urge, I think, especially at this time, to move towards communes and stuff like that. And some of them, you know, still kind of exist on small scales around this area. And others, you know, went out in spectacular fashion, such as this one. And actually, there still are Rajneeshis around today. I think there's still some in Oregon and certainly some in India and around the world. And I think, Dennis, I think you mentioned that you knew of some in Oregon, right?
Yeah, and in Washington as well, yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, lots of them. They're living together. Are they just folks not having any sort of communal existence?
There are some folks just living in a town, just you know, on their own. But I know there's a ranch in Central Washington. I've seen that quite a few of them live there. I mean, quite a few being six or seven type, you know. But they're just people like us, so they're still out there. There's still definitely a lot of followers. When the Bhagwan passed away, they had a new leader called Osha as well, and they still have followers around the world.
So Chelsea, I have to wonder about, it's not just about people looking to form religious communities in the West, but also responses to those. That's a big part of this story, too. And Dennis gave us a hint of that when he said that he just saw happy people on the ranch, and he hear the radio reports at night about state officials talking about they have guns out there. But this is like what happened when the Mormons moved into Utah and things like that, too, isn't it? I mean, you had responses of people. Who are these people? Why do they all want to be together like this?
Well, those kind of culture contexts happen not just between religious communities, between, you know, that happened when white settlers came to Southern Oregon. You know, anytime you have these two populations that come from different backgrounds meeting, you have this moment of kind of culture like, what's happening? And sometimes, you know, people work it out. Sometimes there's a power imbalance and leads to, you know, and when it comes to like settlement of the West, you know, the white settlers really, it was basically a process of colonialism. But anytime you have two people with different backgrounds meeting, you have kind of this interesting moment in time that can, it changes both communities for sure. And, you know, usually the history is kind of written by whoever comes out on top. So there's a lot of, you know, instances where these kind of things happen and people respond in different ways, but we don't always have the benefit of 300 hours of footage or all this different, you know, documentary record that can kind of tell us the nuances of that and the extreme reactions to different people that look different and had different agendas.
I think you've already answered my question by using the phrase who came out on top, but I mean, it's very seldom any sort of successful melding of these communities, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's amazing about having the B-roll is, in theory, there's no agenda to that. It's not biased like the final product might have been that went out on the airwaves. You just have people filming what's happening there. So we can look at that today and have a little bit more of an objective view. Plus, you know, as an archaeologist, I'm always thinking about what other records are out there, you know, court records. And like we said, there's, you know, different papers from different people that were dealing with different aspects of this. But also, there's a lot of material culture out there. You know, we did a little, after I watched the documentary, I did a little search on eBay, and there's tarot cards and books and CDs and all sorts of music that went along with the different meditation practices. And there's so much stuff out there. And I think it now has a new value. So people are going to be collecting it. But I also hope more of it might make its way to the historical society or places that can kind of curate it as part of this collection of this really interesting moment in time.
Matthew Cowan, I know that TV stations tended to not save entire newscasts at that time, but they did save finished stories. But did KGW not provide those to you? Was it just the raw footage?
Actually, I don't. They generally did not keep finished stories. So anything that was, if they produced, which is often in the 70s into the 80s, stations would actually produce kind of short little documentaries. So those were often saved, especially if they were shot on 16mm film. But actually things that went out over the air, so kind of like what was shown on this date, you know, the 7 o'clock news hour, was often not saved. It just went out live over the air. So usually if you have news footage that exists now in institutions around the country, it's generally this type of raw B-roll. And usually what exists is the 16mm, which was in use from 1960 to about 1980 or the late 1970s. Once they transferred over to videotape, they often would record over the tape. The tapes would get thrown away. It was just, there was less kind of what I call passive archiving. It's a lot easier to keep a roll of 16 millimeter around on a shelf, and then maybe you throw it away or you give it to your local archive. But videotape was magnetic. It's a lot easier to just record over and keep reusing. And there was not this idea. There was nobody was thinking ahead to, you know, a six-hour documentary or Blu-ray or the internet. It was just, you know, it was about just putting it out and moving on to the next story. And especially in a newsroom, if you've ever worked there, you know, it's just they're on to the next story as soon as the other one's dead. And so maybe they want to go back and reference a particular story. But for the most part, you know, they just keep maybe the big ones, but then they go on. And so, you know, it's odd that this much footage exists at that time and it wasn't thrown away or recorded over.
Well, it's a good thing that the KGW saved this. You said about 300 hours worth of stuff. So that was a lot of what went into the Wild, Wild Country Netflix documentary series. That'll do it for this edition of Underground History. Matthew Cowan, the film archivist at the Oregon Historical Society. Dennis Griffin, state archaeologist. Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. Thank you all for joining us today on this Underground History segment.